AI New York.
Good evening. The Supreme Court leans towards Trump on immigration. Stephen Miller, the president's immigration factotum, is outed as a white supremacist. And noted reporter Max Blumenthal is arrested in a SWAT raid on his home. With these and other stories, I'm Paul DiRienzo with the WBAI Evening News for Tuesday, November 12, 2019. The Supreme Court's conservative majority signaled support for President Donald Trump's bid to kill a program that protects hundreds of thousands of immigrants, dubbed Dreamers, who entered the United States illegally as children. That comes even as liberal justices complain that the move would destroy lives. There are currently 660,000 immigrants, mostly Hispanic young adults, protected under the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, or DACA, program. DACA was created by President Barack Obama in 2012. The court heard the administration's appeal of lower court rulings that blocked the Republican president's 2017 plan to rescind DACA. Conservative justices questioned whether courts even have the power to review Trump's action. The court's 5-4 conservative majority includes two Trump appointees, Neil Gorsuch and Brett Kavanaugh, who both indicated support for the president's action. A ruling is due by the end of June, just months before the 2020 election. Hundreds gathered at the court today in Washington, D.C. to support attorneys who brought the case, including the Attorney General of California. If the court sides with Trump, the consequences would be devastating. Many thousands could be forcibly deported. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi was one of the speakers at a news conference held after the arguments had been made.
Now, here we are on this day that should be a very hopeful one for our country, where the Supreme Court of the United States will make a decision to either cause pain or find a solution by upholding what we think is the right thing to do. Just to put it in perspective, Ronald Reagan, this is not a partisan issue. President Reagan, when he was president, after the Congress passed the Comprehensive Immigration Bill of 1986, he said to Congress, "You didn't go far enough." And he instituted family fairness, which protected a higher percentage of people in our newcomers to our country than the President Obama's DACA order. A higher percent. After Congress had acted, he said, we should do more. He, President George Herbert Walker Bush, President Clinton, President George W. Bush, President Obama, all subscribed to that, except this president, which is so sad. And now this court has to decide as to whether President Obama was correct in following the lead of President Reagan in protecting newcomers in our country, or to support the illicit act of President Trump and what he did. We urge the court to support the lower court.
And a young DACA recipient, Antonio Alarcon, had this to say.
I came to the U.S. at the age of 10 with my parents. In 2012, due to the death of my parents decided to return to Mexico. But I decided to stay here to fight for their dreams and mine. 2 years ago, I graduated from Queens College in New York, making the first one in my family to graduate from college. DACA for me means the opportunity to work legally and ultimately live without the fear of deportation. For many of us here, this is the only home we know. We have friends, connections, family, and loved ones. Even though my family is in Mexico, I consider Jackson Heights in Queens, New York, my home. I went to school there. I have my friends there, and I plan to have kids in my community. Yeah, right. If the Supreme Court allows the Trump administration's plan to unlawfully end DACA and move forward, it means that we will lose our jobs, that my efforts to get an education and a college degree in a way will be in vain because I won't be able to use it and contribute to my community. DACA has benefited almost a million people like me. It is a successful program and should be maintained. However, we know DACA is not the ultimate solution. Undocumented citizens of this country deserve more. Every single day, we contribute to the economy, to the culture, and into our communities. Therefore, we also need to be acknowledged as the citizens of this country. Today, I hope the court saw the human aspect of DACA, because beyond numbers and statistics, what is at stake is the lives of millions of undocumented people like myself. I hope they also remind themselves that this nation was built and must be continued to be a place that welcomes the contributions of immigrants. And just before I go, I also want to remind our elected officials that we're here, and you see all these beautiful faces and courageous faces, but it's because of our parents' apparent sacrifices. It's not because we shouldn't be blaming our parents, because their decisions are the decisions that they make the best for ourselves. And we wouldn't be here standing with you all without the sacrifices of our parents. So our home is
here.
The Supreme Court previously handed Trump a major victory on immigration policy when it upheld his travel ban blocking people from several Muslim-majority countries from entering the United States. The slew of anti-immigrant orders coming from the White House since Trump's election have found their most ardent supporter in Stephen Miller, a California conservative who has been pushing the Muslim ban and other measures targeting mostly non-white immigrants. Miller has survived purges and toxic battles within the White House staff and is Trump's ear on immigration matters. That has activists concerned because of Miller's well-documented connections to white supremacist groups. Now, the Southern Poverty Law Center says it has the emails and other evidence to back up allegations that Miller is motivated by white nationalism and the belief that non-whites are somehow planning to subsume America's white population. The senior investigative reporter for the Southern Poverty Law Center is Michael Edison Hayden. He says he received a slew of Miller's emails from a whistleblower who once worked for the right-wing blog Breitbart.
In the run-up to the 2016 election, Stephen Miller was in repeated contact with Breitbart editors and writers pushing stories into publication. While he was doing that, he sent white nationalist content, overtly white nationalist content, as well as details that sort of foreshadow, I think, what has been underneath his immigration policies, or the kind of immigration policies that he's helped push under President Trump. He sent, among the Breitbart editors and writers he sent them to was Katie McHugh, was the homepage editor and a writer for them. And in June of this year, McHugh made a decision to leak them to me to analyze and disseminate to the public because of my understanding or my expertise in extremism, and particularly far-right extremism and white nationalism.
There's some examples, we read them, but could you point out maybe some glaring examples of some of the things that he said, that Miller said?
We're going to get more because there's more investigations coming, but he linked to VDare, which is a white nationalist website that believes in the white genocide conspiracy theory. He believed He recommended that she aggregate from American Renaissance. American Renaissance is the, arguably the most famous white nationalist magazine in the world. He bragged about being in contact with Pamela Geller. Pamela Geller is an anti-Muslim extremist. After Dylann Roof murdered nine black churchgoers in South Carolina in June of 2015, Miller did not mention Dylann Roof once, except in the context of talking about how angry he was that people were removing Confederate monuments or removing Confederate symbols from Amazon. So his primary concern after, nine people were killed in that manner by a white supremacist was to push back on this and try to put an alternative story about how, Amazon was, getting rid of Confederate symbols, but they weren't, getting rid of communist symbols or whatever else. I mean, that was his priority, and I think it says a lot about his morals and his ethics. He also promoted the book Camp of the Saints. Camp of the Saints is an egregiously racist book in which, the sort of refugees swarm France and destroy it. They're all dehumanized, kind of evil characters, refugees. And Miller recommended that they write about Pope Francis and his rhetoric in the context of that novel. And you know what? Breitbart did. They did do it. They published an article about it.
So what position does Miller have that makes these beliefs? I think millions of Americans, unfortunately, have views like these or similarly. But what makes it more dangerous that this person, Stephen Miller, has these views? Who is he?
Americans should be highly, highly, highly concerned by the findings in this investigation, because Miller is considered the brains of the Trump administration by many. He is. People always talk about his fingerprints on our most egregious immigration policies. And if you have a person in there who is reading this type of material that utterly dehumanizes non-whites, and then you look at our immigration policies, you can put two and two together, I think, or at least I do, and raise some serious concerns about the way he sees the world and the direction he wants to take America.
What type of he was responsible for some of these, as you said, egregious decisions by the Trump administration regarding immigration. What are some of those things that he's advised?
I'll give you an example from the investigation that is very sort of tit for tat, or this, you know, direct link. Okay, he again, VDare, the white nationalist website, he shared a link from that website in the context of aiding my sources' reporting on the subject of temporary protective status for refugees. Okay, and what has the Trump administration done? They have removed temporary protective status for refugees for non-white countries, for people who are coming from many non-white countries. Or predominantly non-white countries, excuse me. And if that is coming, if his you know, understanding of that subject matter is coming from a white nationalist website, that is not only shocking, but it is you know, shocking on an international scale.
And what was it that the woman was a Breitbart, the woman who was the leaker in this, who was the whistleblower and gave you these emails, she was pretty conservative herself. Wasn't she also an advocate on Breitbart of these kind of views?
Oh, absolutely.
And yeah. She changed? What happened to her?
So McHugh was fired from Breitbart in 2017, and she was very young when she started working there. She started working when she was just 23 years old. So she's 23 years old. She's only 10 months out of college. She gets to Breitbart. The Breitbart editors are telling you need to listen to this guy. And this guy is Stephen Miller. And he's telling her all these things. And he's passing along this white nationalist material. So, yes, McHugh was very, very involved in the anti-immigration movement. And she has suffered as a result of it. She talks about how big a mistake it was repeatedly. I mean, she's called the movement evil to us. Basically, in that time, she has come to terms with what happened, and she did not want to make this about herself. She did not want to make a big deal for herself. You know, she did, to me, this is a woman who did a very heroic thing by turning this stuff over and just letting us lay it bare and report on it without cherry-picking emails. I mean, she doesn't look great in these emails, but she knows it's for the greater cause of exposing what Miller believes and what Miller did at that time.
Yeah, and just to wrap up, you mentioned something earlier about like white genocide or something like that. What is that all about? What does that mean?
In the white nationalist community, it is built into the fabric of their way of seeing that white people are being systematically eliminated from their home countries through immigration. That you know, by race mixing, you know, is the way they would, that is the word that they would use. They, you know, people are, you know, quietly genociding white people. And it is a truly egregious and horrific way of seeing the world. It's also, it's a complete nonsense and an utter lie. Many, you know, white nationalists believe that Jews are deliberately doing this to white people, right? These are anti-Semites, many of them. Miller happens to be Jewish. He refers to elites in this. So there are all different variations of it. But it's the idea that brown people are coming to remove whites in some kind of systematic way. Now, all these websites, they traffic in this nonsense. And then you have Miller reading it, and he is creating policies for the Trump administration. You tell me. To me, that is extraordinarily damning and shocking, and I think that we need to really have a hard look at at what this guy believes. I think people need to ask him some tough questions.
What should we do about this? What do you think should be done?
Mueller should step down. But I believe that other people, my, that's me as an American citizen working on this. My reason for doing it was so far. When I went into reporting on this, I didn't go in with the idea of let me go after Stephen Miller. I focus on extremism. And then I was presented with leak, and I said, let me take a look at what's in it. And when I saw it, I was shocked. And I have dealt with some very serious, material in the neo-Nazi community and people with really terroristic ambitions. And this was truly shocking to me, I could not believe what I was reading when I read it. And I've read it 7 times now.
That this was so close to the president. This was in the leading role area.
So close to the president, but he's often credited with shaping, our policies. And to me, as an American,
has he said anything about DACA?
Yeah, it's in there. Almost every immigration policy you can mention is discussed in these emails. And we're going to roll out future investigations. You're going to see more from what he said.
Michael Edison Hayden is the senior investigative reporter for the Southern Poverty Law Center. And in more immigration news, a judge banned an Arizona border activist charged with harboring immigrants from mentioning President Donald Trump during his retrial. U.S. District Court Judge Rainer Collins granted a motion by prosecutors to bar the mention of the president during the second trial of Scott Warren just before opening statements began on Tuesday. His first trial ended with a deadlocked jury last June. The trial has garnered international attention, and Warren's supporters say humanitarian aid work is increasingly under attack. Warren, 37, is one of 9 members of the group No More Deaths who have been charged with crimes related to their work, although he's the only one facing felony charges. The group leaves water jugs in the desert, searches for injured or dead migrants, and has a camp near the border where members aid people. And you're listening to the news on WBAI, independent and local radio news in New York. I'm Paul DiRienzo. WBAI producer Jesse Lent joins the news with a regular report on Donald Trump as we prepare for the beginning of the impeachment hearings.
I'm Jesse Lent with WBAI's Impeachment Watch. Tomorrow marks a turning point for the impeachment process as Democrats wrapped up closed-door testimony on Friday. Beginning Wednesday at 10 a.m., the witnesses called before the House Intelligence Committee in the House of Representatives will be live in front of the nation's cameras and microphones. Those witnesses will include former U.S. Ambassador to Ukraine, William Taylor, and Deputy Assistant Secretary at the State Department overseeing European and Eurasian Affairs, George Kent, on Wednesday, with former U.S. Ambassador to Ukraine, Marie Yovanovitch, set to testify on Friday. Expect Democrats to invoke Article 2, Section 4 of the Constitution that, quote, the president, vice president, and all civil officers of the United States shall be removed from office on impeachment for and conviction of treason, bribery, or other high crimes and misdemeanors. While Republicans on the Intelligence Committee will most likely look to impugn the way Democrats in the House, led by Speaker Nancy Pelosi, are proceeding with the impeachment process, specifically by not allowing them to call their own witnesses like Hunter Biden, the person President Trump was pressuring the president of Ukraine to dig up dirt on in the phone call at the heart of the inquiry. House Intelligence Committee Chairman Adam Schiff told CNN last week the public hearings will be a chance for Americans to assess witness testimony for themselves, but added that there's been little debate so far as to whether there was a quid pro quo, or in other words, if President Trump withheld aid to Ukraine unless they investigated his potential political rival in the 2020 election, former Vice President Joe Biden.
These will be the first of the open hearings, and I think you will see throughout the course of the testimony, not only their testimony, but many others, the most important facts are largely not contested. We are getting an increasing appreciation for just what took place during the course of the last year and the degree to which the president enlisted whole departments of government in the illicit aim of trying to get Ukraine to dig up dirt on a political opponent, as well as further conspiracy theory about the 2016 election that he believed would be beneficial to his reelection campaign.
For the WBAI Evening News, this has been Impeachment Watch. I'm Jesse Lent.
Thanks, Jesse. And Max Blumenthal, a prominent reporter and critic of U.S. policy toward Venezuela, was arrested by Washington, D.C. police on October 25th. Acting like a SWAT team, the cops broke down his door and held him, preventing him from calling a lawyer for several days. Blumenthal was charged with simple assault for allegedly pushing past a protester while Blumenthal was bringing food to occupiers of the Venezuelan consulate. Blumenthal is editor of Gray Zone, a website dedicated to investigative journalism. He spoke with WBAI about his ordeal.
I was arrested early on in the morning about 2 weeks ago. I've lost track of the date. A team of police officers demanded entry to my house, threatened to break down my door. These were D.C. police and arrested me in my home, took me out in my pajamas into a paddy wagon, and I spent the next 2 days in jail. I was denied the right to call a lawyer or to call anyone. But luckily, my imprisonment was known, so I wasn't incommunicado. But this was a clear violation of my rights. And I was subsequently learned that I was listed as armed and dangerous on the arrest warrant, something that is a designation that appears on about 3% of warrants, according to the National Crime Information Center, almost always on people who have a prior record of homicide or who are on the loose. And my arrest was political persecution. I was falsely accused of simple assault by members of the Venezuelan opposition who were besieging the Venezuelan embassy in May of this year. So for 5 months, I was, traveling in and out of the country, or I was at home, and I was never picked up. I was never arrested. There was no warrant that I knew of. And then suddenly, 5 months later, a warrant was issued for my arrest for a completely false, bogus allegation.
What was the scene when that was happening at the Venezuelan consulate? What was the scene at the consulate when you were there, when this event is supposed to have happened that they charged you with?
Well, I can only say that if the government wants to take this lie to trial, it's a federal case, that the facts will speak for themselves in court. I'm completely innocent of what I'm accused of, and it is a lie and a fabrication by a member of a U.S.-backed opposition element that the Gray Zone, my publication that I founded, and I personally have been producing loads of critical reporting on, basically shredding their narrative around the coup. So it's very clear to me that this is retaliation by this element, which has been working closely with the U.S. State Department and the Trump administration. And our reporting has even resulted in one of their key leaders, Ricardo Houseman, Juan Guaido's ambassador to the Inter-American Development Bank, being forced to quit his position because we reported on his financial conflicts of interest. I think we are the leading English language publication in shredding the narrative of the Venezuelan coup mongers. And so 5 months after this whole embassy siege ended and they seized the Venezuelan embassy in D.C. in violation of international law, I'm arrested and thrown in jail for 2 days I'm facing a trial for a false charge cooked up by this right-wing element.
Wow. And what happened? What's the actual charge, and what happens next?
The charge is simple assault, which is a misdemeanor. And many people I was in prison with, when we got to be arraigned before a magistrate judge, before facing the judge, their charges were thrown out. This is a charge that's almost always thrown out because it's such a minor charge. It could, it's not assault and battery. It's simple assault, which could mean, threatening someone or something. I didn't commit that act any way you slice it. But what's notable is that the government is pursuing this charge and trying to take it to trial when it's usually dropped in almost every case.
What do they say to you? I know you can't talk about the case while it's open, but I'm curious how they're justifying this craziness.
I haven't heard anything from the government side yet. I have a status hearing on November 22nd, and I'll see what they're up to there. It would that's typically where a trial date is set, and I expect them to take this sham of a lie to trial.
Mm-hmm. And why did they say you had a gun again? It wasn't very clear there either why you'd be armed or why they would think such a thing.
There's no record of violence in I have no criminal history. So that needs to be answered for by the DC police. I was put at risk. I likened this to the phenomenon of swatting, where people just call a SWAT team on, their enemies online. And it was kind of like the equivalent of being swatted by the Venezuelan right-wing opposition and the federal government, which used these Venezuelan coup mongers used the DC police as a tool of revenge against me, inventing this lie. And then, they appear not just, one or two cops, but five or six, with a number on the side of my house as if I was going to jump out of the window and run. When I'm completely cooperative. So, yeah, they have a lot to answer for. And if there had been a warrant out for me, they could have called me or found me and told me to just turn myself in and show up at my own arraignment. I had nothing to fear. I have nothing to hide. I'm completely innocent. I would have done that. Instead, I spent 36 hours either in a cell or in various forms of shackles and being subjected to intrusive body searches.
All right. Anything you'd like to add?
I just want to thank everyone out there for all the support they've shown to me. And, it's important to support the four embassy protectors, David Paul, Adrian Pine, Kevin Zeese, and Margaret Flowers, who are facing a year in prison for being the final four in the embassy, standing up for international law.
And that's Max Blumenthal, the editor of Gray Zone, a website dedicated to investigative journalism. And just a moment to take a moment to editorialize, to ask the listeners to support this kind of journalism. Very few outlets have spoken about what happened to Max Blumenthal, how he was targeted as a journalist. And there's so many cases where a journalist is attacked or even criticized and the media comes out and they get behind this guy. But if you're a progressive journalist, you don't seem to have the same kind of background or backing, people at your back, as you do if you're part of the corporate journalistic world, of which decidedly Max Blumenthal is not. He's been doing great work for a long time on Middle East, on Gaza, on Israel, on the Likudniks. He's been doing work on Venezuela, and he was down there covering the embassy occupation, which we also covered here on WBAI very closely. So when he was targeted by these right-wing Venezuelans who were out there picketing, who went and trumped up charges against him, and the police go hog wild with this allegation, and months later bust down his door and drag him out. This is in a country that's supposed to have freedom of speech, and yet you don't hear about it on any media but on WBAI. So this is a good reason to support this media outlet. All right, we need your support to survive. Give to WBAI.org, G-I-V-E to WBAI.org. Now, WBAI has had the same thing, where we have been silenced and we came back fighting, and we are fighters. We will always be there for you. We just ask you to be there for us and for journalists like Max Blumenthal, who we feature one of the few, very few places in only the most progressive of media will you hear this story. It's very unfortunate in a land where there's supposed to be freedom of press and freedom of speech. Give to WBAI.org. G-I-V-E, number 2, WBAI.org. Become a BAI buddy in name of the news. This is your opportunity to support the WBAI news and show that you support the work we've been doing here. And that's some of the news for Tuesday, November 12th, 2019. The news was engineered by Reggie Johnson. For the WBAI Independent and Local News, I'm Paul DiRienzo.